This Stew Lectures episode features founder of Ballymallow Cookery School, Dorina Allen, recorded live at the global event in Cardigan, West Wales in 2010.
Thank you very much. Well, just about 10 minutes ago, I discovered that what I thought was to be a 45-minute talk was 25 minutes. So I'll speak even faster than usual. I come, as Andrew just said, from Ballymallow in East Cork on the south coast of Ireland. And just to give you a little tiny bit of background, Andrew also asked me a couple of minutes ago what was I going to speak about. And I kind of looked baffled and said, well, I'm going to speak about what you asked me to speak about, actually, which was how to earn a living staying on the land if you have, and I'll explain to you why it came to making a decision. So just to give you a tiny bit of background, I'm a very much a country girl. I was the eldest of 9 children brought up in a tiny village in the Midlands of Ireland. And there was always cooking going on our house. And, you know, you can imagine with 9 kids, by the time you'd finished cleaning up from one meal, it was almost time to start another one. So I kind of learned how to cook by osmosis, watching what was going on around me. And my father was the village merchant. He was most definitely, looking back on it now, and my grandfather, both entrepreneurs. They, they sold whatever was needed by the local community and all of that. And we had a vegetable garden and a house cow and hens and all of that sort of thing. And then I was sent off to boarding school and educated by the Dominicans in Wicklow, over close to Dublin. And the only thing I really knew anything about was what I'd seen going on at home, really, was cooking and gardening. So when it came to make a decision about what I was going to do with my life, that was the only thing I could think about. And would I do horticulture or would I cook? I really wanted to learn how to cook. But at that stage, the career guidance teachers and so on were a bit appalled by that, because chefs and cooks had absolutely... It wasn't a bit posh to be a chef or a cook. They had no status. It was long before, as you can see, before the years of celebrity chefs or anything like that. So I was encouraged to do hotel management, which I did. I went off to the hotel school in Dublin and did that. And then there was another decision to be made at the end of that course. What would I do next? And so it was a management course, and really, but there were some cooking sessions as well. And I never mitched the cooking sessions, but I often went off and played poker and other stuff. My son is here. I shouldn't be divulging this. But anyway, choose some of the other things. And I love the cooking. At the end of the... So I was trying to decide, I really wanted to learn how to cook more. I knew about sort of basic fresh herbs and things like that. But this is in the 60s, in the late 60s. How did you make a souffle? How did you make terrines and homemade ice cream? And what would you... I hadn't even heard of basil, but I did hear of some other herbs, apart from the parsley and chives and thyme that my mother grew in the... I was longing to learn more. But at that stage, men were chefs and women just ran tea shops or kept out of mischief or something. You couldn't get... more or less, you couldn't get into a top kitchen. I just couldn't get into any of the top restaurants in Ireland. You never know in your life what's the little thing that can change the course of the rest of your life. And it was one day in the corridor, very close to the end of the course, I met one of the head lecturers in my college, and she said she had a kind of interest in me because she had taught my aunt years earlier. And she said, "Have you got a job yet?" And most other people in my class had. And I said no, and I told her what I was trying to find, and she told me I was far too fussy, but anyway, wouldn't I get a job like anybody else? She said, funny, I was told, because I told her I wanted to learn more about what I've just said and all these kind of things. And she said, well, funny, I was at a dinner party the other night, and they were talking about an extraordinary woman down in Cork who's opened a restaurant in her own house in a farm right out in the wilds of East Cork. And, you know, this, by the way, was an extraordinary thing to do at that time. It was in the early 60s. There were no country house hotels in Ireland, and I think there were maybe one or two over here. But anyway, and so she said, I can't remember her name, but I know they have a Jersey here. They make homemade ice cream from their own Jersey cream, and they have pigs, and it's in the middle of a farm, and they have... She writes the menu every day, and this sounded like an incredibly amateurish thing to do at that time. When restaurants opened, usually the chef wrote the menu. When the restaurant opened, it was the same 10 years later. So the idea of writing the menu every day, depending on what was in season or was in your garden, what fish came in from the boats in Ballycotton or whatever, was considered very amateurish. But anyway, I thought my eyes lit up, and I thought, that's exactly what I'm looking for. So she went away, and a few days later, she just gave me a little piece of paper, and the name on the piece of paper was Myrtle Allen, who's now my mother-in-law. So there you are. So I became a member of the family by the simple expedient of marrying the boss's son. So that's how it's done. So that's one way of doing it anyway. And I had, honestly, this is completely true. I had absolutely no ambition, really, to be anything. I just really was on the lookout for a nice chap that keep me and, you know, so I could play house and maybe have a few cute little children and have picnics and all of that sort of thing. And I came to Ballymaloe, and then I met this extraordinary woman, Myrtle Allen, who taught me the opposite of everything virtually that I'd ever learned, certainly at hotel school. It was more or less the same philosophy as my mother's. And so I was like a sponge. I soaked up everything she said and all of that. It was really wonderful. She's now still very much hale and hearty, 86 going on 18. But anyway, and I feel very fortunate that our paths crossed in life. I know not everybody says that about their mother-in-law, but anyway. And we were fortunate to inherit a beautiful Regency house in 100 acres, another farm just close to Ballymaloe. And I loved to cook, and so we settled down. And after a bit, started to make jam, and I'd sell the jam. And then, we had absolutely no money. We had this lovely house and a rusty Renault 4L car, but no money. So I kind of made jam, and then I cleaned out some of the bedrooms in the house and took overflow from Ballymaloe on a sort of B&B basis until the children got so big they refused to move out of their rooms. So I had to think of something else. And then I started a little farm shop. I believe now it was the first farm shop in Ireland. And that was years and years ago. I must try and get dates on some of this sometime. And I worked, of course, in Ballymaloe House as well, in the kitchens. And when Myrtle was writing her book, the Ballymaloe Cookbook, which is still in print after 40-something years, I ran the kitchen. And because of the various skills I'd built up, I could sort of dress a bed or wait on table or pull a pint or be trolley-dolly or anything. So it's a great thing in life, actually, to have as many practical skills as you can, as well as everything else. And my husband was in horticulture. We had quite a big horticultural unit, 5 acres of greenhouses, about 65 acres of apples, large mushroom unit, employing about 100 people, which had been started by my father-in-law. And that was all fine, great business, all of that. And then it came to the 60s, before so many of you in this room were born. I was a bit horrified to see that I was only the only white-haired woman in the whole place when I came. I nearly ran home again. In the late 60s, up to then, labour costs more or less stayed more or less the same year in, year out. Then they started to rise, and then by the late 70s and early 80s, we had the last recession in Ireland and over here and so on. And there was the oil crisis, you remember, and then there was, we were heating 5 acres of not very modern greenhouses with oil. And so we went, within a couple of years, and there was also 25% inflation. So within a couple of years, we went from being a very profitable business to almost losing the roof over our heads, and we had 4 small children. And we thought, what the heck are we going to do now? So getting to the point of the whole talk, we had to do something drastic. We loved our house. We love our land. I wanted to find a way. We both wanted to find a way to earn a living on the land that we love and to stay in the country, rear our children in the country, terribly important to us. I didn't want to get into a car and drive in and out of Cork every day. So we had to look at what talents we had, what resources we had between us, and try and earn a living in a different way. So we had, there were some farm buildings around the back of our house in quite bad condition, but anyway, and actually before that, we converted some of the farm buildings, into a little holiday house that people could come. I'd do anything to make a few bob, actually. So we had to find a living a different way. We'd also started another farm shop. And then in the winter, my mother-in-law had been giving cooking classes on and off to fill the rooms in Ballymaloe during the winter when we weren't so busy. So I'd been helping her to do that. And then she decided, if you don't mind, to open a restaurant in Paris. That our family is 4 generations of mad women. But anyway, imagine an Irish woman getting into her, again, rusty car and heading off to open a restaurant called La Ferme Irlandaise in Paris to be a showcase for Irish food in Paris. It was very successful, never made any money, but was a page and a half in the New York Times and all of that, if you call that success. She then had gone off to do that. So people kept ringing up and saying, could they have more cooking classes? So at that stage, I wasn't in it. My name meant absolutely nothing and so on. And I hardly had the courage, but we really needed the money. And that's a very good incentive to do something, to get up and do something. And so I picked up the courage, put a little ad in. My mother-in-law said to me, well, why don't you go ahead and give the classes and so on? So I thought nobody would come, but I put a little ad in our local paper, the Cork Examiner, who reckons to be a national paper. And saying cooking classes Saturday mornings. And to my amazement, people people came and in little mink jackets and all the great big BMWs and all the rest of it. And I hid my rusty car around the back and got started. And with anything in life, the first time you do it is the most scary. And then once you do that and you survive the first talk you give or the first class you give or whatever, well, then it gives you courage to go on to the next. So we got started, and I just started with Saturday morning classes. And then, as I said, we had another big farm shop on the farm, little cafe, well, I say big farm shop, and I started a little garden cafe behind it. And by the way, at a time when you could just decide that you were going to start something in a shed on your farm and put a cafe out of the back, and people would flock to it, and you didn't have a ton of people coming with books of rules telling you can't do this and you can't do that, which, by the way, in my opinion, is one of the biggest impediments to entrepreneurial spirit and all of that that we have to contend with nowadays. But anyway, so we did this, and then I again another sort of eureka moment was when, having worked terribly hard all summer and everything, I was desperate to learn more about Italian food. This was in about 1980, I'd say. And I heard about this woman called Marcella Hazan in Italy who was giving cooking courses on Italian food. And we found out the price of it. It was like phenomenal, something like 600 euros for a week. This is back then. And we had just about no money. But anyway, my husband somehow or other decided that, having worked so hard, that this would be, that he would give me a present of this. And, you know, to say that it was like totally crazy because we hadn't got the money was, anyway, there I was, went off to Italy. I'd heard so much about Italian food, marvellous course, wonderful visits to markets, all that kind of thing. And all week we heard about how wonderful Italian food was. And all the years my mother-in-law had been saying, you know, what we have in Ireland, what we grow on this farm, what we have in the gardens is as good as anything anywhere in the world. The flavour is wonderful and so on. But, you know, in Ireland particularly, we had a real inferiority complex. We were sure that what they had in the US or the UK had to be better than what we had there. So I went to Italy and they were talking about how wonderful the food was, and it was wonderful. But at a fish dinner on the last night in Cesenatico, there on the side of on the Adriatic, everybody was raving about the fish, and I was tasting this fish thinking, my God, the fish that we get from the boats in Ballycotton is better than this. You know, and I suddenly thought the answer to my problem, my dilemma, is right under my nose, under my own feet. I'm living on a farm in Ireland. We grow a lot of stuff. We have our own gardens and all of the rest of it. So basically, all I have to do is put it together. The obvious place to have a cooking school is in the middle of a farm where you have all your produce around you. So anyway, to cut a long story short, came home, decided to get onto the bank manager. Oh my God. At that stage, it was just like now, you know, everybody was sort of saying you haven't a hope of getting money from the bank or anything like that. And I'm absolutely hopeless still at anything to do with figures or economics. I really am. Somebody else has to do that. Otherwise, we'd be totally broke. But it's really, really true. So anyway, I worked out somehow, I don't know how we worked out, that we needed 18,000 to convert some more of the farm buildings into a little cooking school. So I made I've had it more or less on the back of an envelope. And a friend of mine who does know about figures said, you have no point of going to the bank with that, because you have to sort of speak. So I had to speak bank jargon and all of that sort of thing. I mean, I hardly knew what the difference between a debtor and a creditor. I was that bad. But I had a real gut feeling that this could work. I thought at that stage there was no residential cooking school in Ireland. Some people were going to Cordon Bleu in London and Paris, not very many. But I thought, well, if I could start this little cooking school, surely some of those people would come to us. And then we could stay on the farm. We could bring people in and bring the money in and so on. So anyway, went off to make an appointment with the bank manager, borrowed a little suit, dressed myself up and learned off what my friend told me. And I went in and I told the bank manager in where we had our little overdraft that I had this brilliant idea. I was going to start a cooking school out in converted farm buildings out in Chenegarry. I just needed a little more money to do it, and that I thought people would come, and that I thought people eventually might come from abroad and everything. And so everybody said how awful the bank managers were and I'd never get the money and all the rest of it. But anyway, he was so nice. He gave me tea and USA biscuits and all of the rest of it, and we sat down, and he, the more I talked and more excited I became, the more relaxed, and you know, he seemed to think it was a terrific idea. And anyway, he said, well, the usual thing, I'll discuss with my colleagues, you know, I'll let you know in a day or two. And I was sure that it was, I think nobody had ever properly said no to me, but anyway, about a couple of days later I got the letter. It said, you know, that more or less the tone of it was, well, we need to try and save you from yourself, more or less. So anyway, I was absolutely shocked, and I had been talking about it to my parents-in-law and all of that. And so anyway, I was, you know, in life, every now and then, we get a little hand from somebody which can make the difference to our lives. And this, my parents-in-law had chatted, and my father-in-law said, well, look, Myrtle and I think this is a good idea. We think you should forget about your bank, go to our bank, and we'll go guarantor. So I was so fortunate that at that time that somebody believed that it could work. So went along, any bank will give you money if somebody would guarantee you, as you well know. So I went along, and I think the first bank manager had a sense, all right, because I asked for 18 and I spent 80. Actually, not, it sounds worse than it was, but because I actually converted a bit more accommodation. Because, see, we live right out in the country and we needed a bit more accommodation for students. But anyway, I met that bank manager years later and I said to him, do you remember me coming into you years ago? And he said, oh, I remember it well. And I said, you know, you fooled me completely. I thought that, you know, you thought it was a great idea. And he said, well, and I said, you look so, you know, relaxed and everything. He said, well, when you started talking, he said, I thought I might as well sit back and enjoy it. He just thought I was. I said, aren't you sorry you didn't lend me the money now because I borrowed so much since? But anyway, there we are. I got started, and the other piece of great luck that I had was, you know, my name wasn't in any way known at that time, as I kept saying. So what would we call this cooking school? Would we call it Doreena Allen's Cooking School or Shanagarry Cooking School or whatever? So my parents-in-law again said, we think you should call it Ballymaloe Cooking School. Now, because of the Country House Hotel had been established since the 1960s, the name Ballymaloe already stood for something of quality and of all of that sort of thing. So that was a huge help to me, but also it gave me a big responsibility to actually deliver what was expected from that name. I was really determined to do that anyway, because I thought if I was going to start a cooking school, I knew I was going to have to work really hard, and I don't mind working hard. I've always been fortunate to have high energy and all of that, but I thought it might as well be as good as anything anywhere else. So I trotted off to the UK and went to look at some of what I thought were the best cooking schools over here, and Prulitz and Cordon Bleu wouldn't let me inside the door, actually, by the way. I got in later, but anyway. But there were several others, and I looked to see you know, what they were doing, and because they were the ones that it was the yardstick by which I wanted to measure my thing. So anyway, we got started, and in September 1983, I put a couple of little ads in the Examiner and also in the Irish Times. Ballymaloe Cookery School opens September 1983, and I was very fortunate that people, when they read the ad, thought it was at Ballymaloe itself, so they didn't realise that we were still desperately converting farm buildings, and it wasn't ready until about 4 hours before people walked in. But anyway, started with 9 students, and then the following term there were 11, and so on. And we had no money really for advertising or anything, so we did very little advertising. But when journalists, food writers, and journalists came to Ballymaloe, my father-in-law would say, "Oh, you know, my son and daughter-in-law are doing a little school over there," and he'd bundle them into the car and bring them over, and we'd give them lunch and the way to everybody's heart through their tummy. Okay, then from the very beginning we operated year-round. We were doing day courses, weekend courses, weeks, etc. And then I also did 2-night classes a week. So I just worked from dawn to dusk. It had to work, because our back was against the wall. We would lose our place. We had our children. We wanted to educate them and maybe have a little holiday or something. That was one of the things we'd have liked to have had at that stage. So within 2 years, we had our first American student. I remember her name very well. Her name was Tammy Dillon. And then next time we were doing the brochure, we wrote Ballymaloe International Cooking School. I liked the speaker earlier who said you have to pretend you're big. But anyway, and then I remember her reading it and saying, am I the I in international? We had no PR company or marketing company. We've never have had, actually. But we've always, and the food we, the kind of cooking we do is, we thought the sort of Ballymaloe food, the food, you know, that our food is very simple. We just cook the food of our farm and our gardens and local area and what's in season at that time. There'll be fish from the boats in Ballycotton. And this not, is not a conversion to the road to Damascus. It's how we've always been. We'll just skip over some of that. So basically, there were two things. It had to work. That was one thing. The second thing was, so basically all I know about business, and I've no business training really, is to promise less and give more. Mostly advertising promises more, and when your actual your experience then is that it's not, it doesn't quite measure up to it. So I wanted everybody who came to feel they got not only value for money, but much, much more. So that at least we would have people word of mouth, which was quite slow, but at the same time. And then we got a lot of unsolicited write-ups from food and travel writers who came and visited the place when they were coming to Bamloo as well. So at first we weren't organic, but I learned, and as you teach, you learn more and more all the time. And every time I went to London, I'd ask to go into some restaurant kitchens for a couple of days. I was desperate to learn, read, learned, cooked, tested, etc. And then as I learned more, I became more and more uneasy about how food was being produced, particularly on a large scale and so on. And then we were in the middle of the farm. At this stage, the farm land was actually being farmed by my brother-in-law, who was a conventional farmer. And I was preaching about fresh and local and seasonal to all my students every day. And then there was another seminal moment. I remember being in the demonstration area one day and talking about the importance of the quality of the food and freshness and purity and all that. And I look out through the window of the demonstration area, and there's one of my brother-in-law's men with a tractor, with a sprayer with a boom as wide as the tent here, spraying God knows what onto one of our fields. And before this, I'd been saying to my husband, I really want to go organic. But at that moment, I thought, I can't do this anymore. Morally look my students straight in the face and not have the farm organic. And I felt so uncomfortable about it myself and for everything else. So I went in and I said to my husband, look, we must go organic. We had this farm. And, remember, we'd almost lost the roof over our heads through farming. So the idea of even going back into farming, not to speak of going back into organic farming, was such a stretch for everybody. So Tim was terrified it was going to be like a big black hole, that whatever money we made in the cooking school was going to go back into. So I had to promise that no matter what happened, we'd break even, that this farm would break even, that I would make sure it didn't lose money. So at that, we are, as a family, we're quite anti-grant. We generally reckon on sort of borrowing a bit of money, work like mad, pay it back, and so on. But anyway, I asked him whether I could join the Rural Environmental Protection Scheme, which would tide us over while we were in conversion. And eventually, so we converted and then we went organic. And of course, that's about 15 years ago now, and you can't imagine how wonderful it is and all of that. Anyway, then we converted more farm buildings into more accommodation, and now we take 62 students. They come from all over the world. I think 13 nationalities is the most we've had in a 12-week course at any one time. And we have one teacher to every six students. And it makes a huge, our little school in the middle of a very rural area makes a huge difference to the local economy, because the students, shop in the local shops, drink in the local pubs, as you can imagine. And also, we've been responsible for bringing some new blood into the area as well. So that's it. So then, I press this button for slides. Do I just do... Yes, just to very quickly do a few slides. How are we doing? Am I all right on time? Now, so this, just to give you an idea, we're right beside the sea. That's not a very good slide, but that's the sea there at Ballycotton, where we get our fish. Now, on the first day when the students come to the school, particularly on the 12-week certificate course, these are students who are going to be with us on this 3-month, very intensive course, who want to earn their living from their cooking, be chefs and cooks and so on. And by the way, I'm such an old bat of a headmistress now that if I had my way, no chef or cook would go into a kitchen until they spent at least a year on a farm or in gardens. So they actually understand how food is produced and don't have this incredible arrogance that chefs so often have, where they thump the table and they say, I want it and I want it now, and they don't know whether it's in season, or they have no idea of the reality of nature, how crops can fail, etc. So when they come on the first morning, the first thing I do is introduce them to the gardeners and the farm manager. And then we go out around, out into the garden, and I run my hands through the soil, just like there, and I say to them, remember, this is where it all starts, in the good earth. And, preferably if I have a few little worms scribbling around in it as well. And actually, it's from the compost that the students would have made compost, that literally is in my hand there. And they look at me and they think, oh my God, it didn't say anything about this in the brochure. some kind of aged hippie on a mission. But I have to shock them into thinking of food that something comes wrapped in plastic off a supermarket shelf. I need them to think about how food is produced, where it comes from, the breed, the feed, and to realise that all of us depend on the 5 or 6 inches of soil that's around our planet to feed us and for our very being. So I am running my fingers to the soil. The first recipe they get is how to make compost. And literally, and then that's, they don't think, we don't put that in the brochure either, but anyway. Then we go down to the greenhouses. We still have 1 acre of greenhouses that we've kept. It's a marvellous resource. And we grow over 85 crops on the farm, little, small amounts of it. So there's the students being shown how to sow a seed, and then we give each of them a little plant, and they plant it into the ground with a little lollipop stick with their name on it. And I don't know of any better way to give people a respect for food and the people who produce our food, grow it and rear it for us, than to give them a seed and let them plant it and let them watch it grow and wait for it to grow. And people are astonished that it can take 12 months and in many cases, and sometimes longer than that, to grow something. And then they handle the food in a completely different way, they treat it in a different way, and they won't boil the hell out of it when they get it into the kitchen. And that's a very important lesson. This is on the first day. There they are planting up their little plants. We also have gardening classes then. And this is our herb garden at the school. The students, by the way, after that, they need to go out with the gardeners on a rota basis every morning, bringing in vegetables and herbs. Because it's a small organic farm, we have about 60 arable acres, 100 acres altogether. We have some cattle, and we have 2 Jersey cows, so we have our own milk every morning, and the students can also learn how to milk a cow if they want to. Now, that's actually voluntary, but most students actually learn how to milk a cow because we joke about it that they can put it on their CV, can milk a cow. We'll get the conversation going anyway, whatever about anything else. We also have some pigs, and so we've fattened those up, and then we do, we also do apart from cooking courses, we also do forgotten skills courses now on how to cure a pig in a day and make salami and bacon and all those sort of things again. And then the other day I put again in some eggs into the incubator. This is actually on the gravel there, but normally lives in our office. I'm sure I'm breaking about 20 EU regulations by having an incubator in our office. But anyway, we put in the little eggs, fertile eggs. 21 days later, the chicks hatch out. Can you imagine the excitement? They're the most photographed chicks that you ever imagine. And then, so this is all about, you see, our farm we have indoor classrooms in the school. The farm and the gardens are an outdoor classroom. And it's all about how food is produced, where it comes from. When the students have been cooking in the morning, after they've been cooking, they scraps, they look at it, and does it go into the stock pot or does it go into the hens' bucket? So there, and then they feed the hens. The students actually, having paid 10,000 for their course, have to feed the hens every day. Here we are. This is our composting system as well. We put in the food into a skip, and then the hens jump into it, associated with food. They eat all the cooked food. Then we put straw on top, and that goes onto our compost then to make lovely compost to make the soil more fertile. You see, there are wiggly worms on my hand there. I tell them how important the worms are in the soil. Well, sorry, did I have to do that 1 minute ago? Oh yeah, sorry, that's just more of that. And then this is like the greenhouse being an indoor classroom with they can identify all the things. This is a gardening course every Wednesday morning. Well, in the beginning when we started this a few years ago, these again are the same chefs and cooks, trainee chefs and cooks. 3 or 4 people would turn up, get out of bed, by the way, about an hour and a half earlier to do this. Now, well over half the class will do this. And we now have started since last year giving a little plot of ground to any student or a raised bed who wants to grow something while they're with us. And that's, again, this is one of our, actually, this is my daughter Emily, in fact, digging potatoes. It's magic to dig potatoes. Then we also, I started the farmers market, farmers market movement, so to speak, in Ireland after I came back from seeing one in San Francisco years and years ago, about nearly 16 years ago now. And this is so then the students can come with us to the farmers market on a Saturday morning and learn how to set up a farmers market, how to prepare things for a farmers market. And several of our students now earn their living by running farmers markets. And one of our past students, you may even know over here, Clodagh McKenna is her name. She started in the farmers market, then wrote books about farmers markets and so on. And also then, as I said, we do these forgotten skills courses. So this is one of our an artisan producer producer called Frank Krajcek, who makes one, he's Polish, he makes wonderful salamis and chorizo and all that sort of thing as well. And, oh yeah, by the way, around Ballymaloe House and the cooking school, Alice referred to this earlier, what we don't produce ourselves, as far as possible, we buy locally. So we've set up, through the years, this whole network of small producers, people who rear chickens and ducks and geese for us, people who smoke fish, who make salamis, and so on. And so the Ballymaloe and the cooking school is integrated totally into the community in that sort of way. And then we buy from them. We get the most beautiful produce from them because we can't do the kind of food we do, which is very simple, without really good quality produce to start with. And then every week at the school, we have a producer of the week so that we invite in when somebody's coming in with their produce. This is Frank Heatherman, who is an artist and fish smoker from Bell Valley near Cove. So when Frank is delivering in his smoked fish, he comes in, I introduce him to the students, and I say, this is the person who smoked this beautiful fish for you. And we go and visit, we have a school tour, we go, am I meant to be finished?
Yes.
Oh, sorry, I was finished now. That's another chap, one of the young breed of artists and producers, and so on. Another little organic farmer, Jana Ferguson, who makes the Gubbin cheese, so we take the students to see this as well. I think that's nearly it. Lovely. This is a local farmer who just grows just wonderful flowery spuds, and that's the fisherman just delivering in the fish. Students cooking in the kitchen, more students cooking in the kitchen, more students having lunch. These are the converted farm buildings where the students stay. That's part of the garden. And oh God, there we had that already. And then these are just some tomatoes and so on. And that's it. And thank you all very much. I'm sorry to go.
The Do Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people in the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or if you prefer, watch on our website, thedolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favourite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out.